Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Fugitive Waiver Rule and Federal Habeas Review Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 8, 2009, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Beard v. Kindler. This case concerns the Adequate State Ground Doctrine, which, among other things, precludes habeas review of a conviction that rests on an adequate state ground. The question in this case was whether applications of a state rule may constitute an adequate state ground even though, under the relevant state rule, dismissal of these motions is discretionary rather than mandatory. Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court, in which all of the other justices joined, except Justice Alito, who took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. The court held that a state procedural rule is not automatically inadequate under the adequate state ground doctrine, and therefore unenforceable on federal habeas review, merely because the state rule is discretionary rather than mandatory. Justice Kennedy filed a concurring opinion that Justice Thomas joined. To discuss the case, we have Southern University Law Center Professor Michelle R. Getty. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Getty.
Hello, this is Professor Michelle Getty. And I'm here to talk to you today about the case of Kindler versus Beard, Pennsylvania case up in the Supreme Court at 130 Supreme Court 612 that was decided on December 8th in 2009. It was an 8-0 decision. Alito did not participate since he had sat on the Pennsylvania Appellate Court during the time this case was being decided. It is remarkable for a few reasons and also non-remarkable for a couple of reasons. As Robert stated in the decision, the holding was non-controversial. In fact, both of the parties arguing before the court agreed to the answer to the question posed. So it was certainly not anything that was particularly remarkable on the holding of the law in the case. However, I found that it was notable for a few reasons. One was consensus building. Two was a matter of comedy. Three was, as it discussed, an affront to the dignity of a court's proceedings. And four is basically a position of the court, in my opinion, that where they were saying what's good for the goose is also good for the gander. To me, it was notably, principally as an excellent example of what I find Chief Justice Roberts to be extraordinary at doing since he's been the Chief Justice and on the court. He has an ability to gain a majority, in this case a unanimous court, by getting an agreement on the most narrow issue possible, and that's what he did in this case. The issue, as it was posed in the case, was whether or not a state procedural rule would automatically be inadequate and therefore unenforceable in a habeas corpus proceeding when the state rule is discretionary or allows the court some discretion rather than a mandatory rule. In fact, as I said before, he had both counsel agreeing to the result in the case, and I'll read quickly from the transcript. He said, "Counsel, following up on that, I'd like your answer to this question. Is a state procedural rule automatically inadequate and therefore unenforceable when the state rule is discretionary rather than mandatory, automatically?" And the defense counsel said, "No, it's not automatically inadequate." Chief Justice Roberts said, "So you agree with the petitioner's response to that question. Their point, their question presented is it automatically inadequate because there's discretion? They say no, you say no." And the defense counsel went around a little bit and finally said, "Correct, correct." And Chief Justice said, "Well, if some of us, or I suppose if several of us, think that that may have been or was what the Third Circuit said, would you have any objection to us vacating the opinion, explaining, since you both agree that the rule is not automatically inadequate, make sure they understand that, and then they can proceed however they see fit?" And defense counsel said, "I have no objection to that." And that's what Justice Roberts and the unanimous court did, was vacate and remand on the most narrow of issues. Broadly, however, the issue in the case was a matter of comity and federalism in a criminal proceeding, specifically in post-conviction relief. According to the Supreme Court, in federal habeas cases, a federal court cannot rule on the merits of a habeas petitioner's claims when a state court has found such claims to be procedurally barred or procedurally defaulted pursuant to an independent and adequate state procedural rule that is firmly established and consistently and regularly applied by the state's courts. That's been the rule of the Supreme Court in habeas petition for years. At issue in this case was a Pennsylvania procedural rule that's known as the Fugitive Forfeiture Rule, which allows Pennsylvania courts to dismiss all appeals in a case if the defendant became a fugitive from justice, in other words, escaped. In its writ application, the Commonwealth had tailored its issue very narrowly. Was the fugitive forfeiture statute not an adequate state ground to uphold the state court's rulings because it allowed the court discretion to dismiss all the claims or not? In other words, once a person had fled, they came back and they wanted then to appeal rulings in the case. If the court had discretion to reinstate any motions they had made or any appeals they had made, and sometimes granted that request to reinstate, sometimes didn't. Did that make the rule, therefore, not firmly established or not consistently and regularly applied? During a very confusing oral argument in which Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg peppered both counsel with many questions, Chief Justice Roberts was able to crystallize the issue, as I mentioned before. And again, as I mentioned before, both counsel agreed that the answer to that question was that the fact that the court had discretion alone would not automatically disqualify the rule. The court then remanded to the Third Circuit to consider the case accordingly and held that a discretionary state procedural rule can serve as an adequate ground to bar federal habeas review. That's it pretty much in a nutshell. What was interesting was, as many cases in the last few years, as we've seen in many of these cases in the last few years, this case was more about what didn't happen than what did happen. So it's kind of important to look at the facts of the case to see what didn't happen. And I say that with tongue-in-cheek a little bit because even, I believe, Justice Roberts found a lot of what was in the background to be very important. He took, of a 4.5-page long opinion, he took 3 pages of that to set forth the facts and only 1.5 pages on the law. So I think you'll find the facts interesting. This case involved a criminal defendant named Joseph Kindler. If you watched America's Most Wanted, you might be familiar with his name. But in 1982, Joseph Kindler, Scott Shaw, and David Bernstein burglarized a store in Pennsylvania. The police stopped their getaway car as they sped from the scene and took Shaw and Bernstein into custody. Somehow Kindler, and as Justice Roberts put it in the decision, kind of a forewarning here, but he managed to escape from the police at that point. But under police questioning, Mr. Bernstein identified Kindler as the driver of the getaway car and the mastermind behind the burglary. He also offered to testify against Kindler. Armed with that information, the police obtained a warrant for Kindler's arrest and arrested him. The warrant had identified Bernstein as the informant, and Kindler subsequently learned that Bernstein had been granted immunity to testify against him. So following his arrest and release on bail, Kindler got back together with one of the other perpetrators of the burglary and devised a plan to kill Bernstein in order to keep him from testifying. Pursuant to that plan, they went to the door of his apartment in the early morning hours of July of 1982. Kindler had been lying in wait and attacked Bernstein, striking him over the head with a baseball bat about 20 times. Acting on Kindler's instructions, the other defendant, co-defendant, then jabbed Bernstein in the ribs with an electric prod numerous times. The two of them dragged the immobilized Bernstein to the other co-defendant's waiting car, leaving a 30-foot trail of blood behind. The two threw him into the trunk of the car, drove to the banks of the Delaware River. They took him from the trunk and threw him into the river. Miraculously, he was still alive when thrown into the river. Realizing that their blows hadn't killed him, they went back into the water, managed to fill his lungs with water, tied a cinder block around his neck to weigh him down, and threw him once again in the river. They then drove back to Kindler's home, discarded their weapons and the other physical evidence, but the police were able to track down one of the co-defendants, the car that this had happened. And within a few hours of the crime, this person basically fell apart and told everything. In her confession, she implicated Kindler and Shaw, directed the police to where the body had been left. They were able to find his body the next day, and it was determined by the coroner that he had not drowned from the beating, but had ultimately been alive when he was thrown into the water and drowned and had massive head injuries and died from that. He was then arrested and tried in state court. The jury convicted him of first-degree murder and criminal conspiracy, and during the penalty hearing, they also found two aggravating circumstances and gave him the death penalty. While he was waiting to have the court actually sentence him, his attorneys filed some post-conviction motions, and while they were waiting to hear the post-conviction motions, he escaped from jail for the first time and fled to Canada. In Canada, he became somewhat of a celebrity. He was kind of on the lam for a number of months and was arrested, and pursuant to some language in a treaty, Canada refused to return him or extradite him to the United States because Canada has no death penalty, and we did have a death penalty, so that was in litigation for a while. Ultimately, Canada agreed to extradite him. Lo and behold, he escapes from jail again. Now, both of his escapes involved violence. The first one, violence to some of the guards. In the second escape from the Canadian prison, they staged a riot in one part of the jail while he and another prisoner crawled up some 30 stories and came out of a skylight at the top of the building, tied sheets together, and went over the side of the building to escape. Kindler escaped. The other defendant wasn't as lucky. The sheets had shredded, and he fell to his death. He was on the lam in Canada for 6 years at that time, and that's when America's Most Wanted got involved. He had become kind of a cause celeb in Canada at the time. He was captured once again in 1988. The court again litigated for 3 years in the courts in Canada, and they finally agreed to extradite him back to the United States. And in fact, on the day of the decision in 1991, they sent him back to Philadelphia. There he had counsel again, and that's when he filed his first motions to reinstate the post-conviction motions. Those had been dismissed as soon as he had escaped pursuant to the fugitive forfeiture law. So those were the facts that kind of went on. He was certainly a defendant who had spit in the face of not only the local Pennsylvania justice system, but the entire United States justice system while he was in Canada, and with quite a lot of celebrity television and media coverage about that when he came back. The Pennsylvania trial court refused to reinstate his motions. That was then appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which found they'd had no obligation to review any of his claims under the fugitive forfeiture law. They did consider, was there a basis for the conviction and the penalty, and basically did the due diligence that's required of the state courts, but didn't consider any of his claims. His claims had been primarily twofold. One of his claims had been that the jury instructions that were given at the penalty stage were unconstitutional because they required the jury to find unanimously some mitigating circumstances. The other claim that was ultimately made, although it was not made in the post-verdict motions, was that he had had ineffective assistance of counsel. The fugitive forfeiture rule, basically procedural rule, is that once you flee, you can't raise any of the claims that you have. So what's remarkable about the case is that basically the court is saying and remanding to the Third Circuit, saying to the Third Circuit, well, the court can have discretion in deciding whether to accept and reinstitute, whether it's post-conviction motions or appeals, either one, and allowing the Third Circuit now to decide to deny any relief to this particular individual. What is also always interesting in many of these cases is what didn't happen. What I found interesting was that Stevens and Ginsburg, who are both ardent anti-death penalty advocates, joined in the unanimous verdict of the court. Neither of them dissented from this case, and neither of them even filed a concurrence with a separate opinion in the case. And I truly believe that's because Roberts held it to such a succinct issue. But this is a death penalty case, and one of the underlying grounds that had been raised was for reversal was an egregious ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The claim itself wasn't egregious. The conduct of the trial attorney was egregious. And what was interesting is only 8 days prior to the Kindler decision, the court in Porter versus McCollum had reversed a death penalty case on ineffective assistance of counsel at the sentencing phase claim in based on facts that were much less egregious than in this case. Just to give you kind of an idea, in this case, they had submitted an affidavit from the trial counsel in Kindler. His affidavit included the following. He stated that Mr. Kindler's case was his first ever capital trial. He said that he did not have any experience or training in how to handle capital cases, in particular the penalty phase of the proceeding. He did not conduct a penalty phase or mitigation investigation in any way. In particular, he did not talk to the defendant or to any of his family members about his family background. His family was available to him. The parents, in fact, had retained him in the case, and they attended the trial. He just didn't think it was important. He also did not attempt in any way to get any school, medical, or other records relating to the defendant. He said he did not have a strategic or tactical reason. It just didn't occur to him that that would be helpful. He also did not consider obtaining any mental health evaluation for Mr. Kindler. Again, there was no strategic or tactical reason for doing so. The defendant also submitted declarations from the parents. His parents, his sister, a friend, a psychologist, and a psychiatrist dealing with his family background, which was quite bad. They detailed his upbringing, where his parents had been alcoholics, where they fought frequently and violently. They threw household items, dishes, shoes, and furniture at each other, where he had witnessed all of these fights. His mother was depressed, often drunk. She had attempted suicide on several occasions. His father was controlling, so much so that he even restricted the amount of water, electricity, and other resources that had been available to the children. The mother and father separated. At that time, the father threatened to kill the mother and the children. The sister described it as living with two crazy people that couldn't control themselves. Both of his parents had abused him, his mother verbally, his father physically. In fact, they threw food at him, dumped soup on his head, physically beat him with electrical cords that would leave welts on his back and blood showing through his shirt. When the parents separated, he ended up living with the father inflicted this abuse on him. There were even instances where the father had thrown bricks at him during a fight. With all of these facts, the court certainly, if taking into account the facts, would have reversed on the fact that the trial attorney had done no investigation of the case at all and had not presented any of these facts to the jury. So this was a death penalty case where Ginsburg and Stevens both agreed to possibly let the verdict stand and not allow him to raise these claims in the future. I think, again, important is both Kennedy and Thomas. Kennedy filed a concurring opinion that Justice Thomas joined in. And we may all be grateful, those of us that believe in comity and federalism, for the concurrence, especially since it was written by Justice Kennedy, who is often a swing vote in this particular area. He was not satisfied with leaving it on such a limited issue, and he wanted to add a bit to this and wanted to give some guidance to the Third Circuit upon remand. He noted that the Third Circuit needed to consider that there were two purposes behind this procedural rule. One was to give notice to the litigant. Therefore, over the years, the courts didn't like newly created rules, rules that had been created after the particular defendant had done whatever caused him to default procedurally. And secondly, the other purpose was to not have bad faith on the part of the courts or the litigants. In other words, they didn't want any changes in procedural rules that they could tell were made to avoid federal review in certain cases, and in particular made reference to the cases during the civil rights area. Kennedy noted that no one could seriously argue that the defendant in this case acted in any way in reliance on the rule when he fled the jurisdiction, and stated during oral argument frequently and also in his opinion that there is no justification for an unlawful escape and that it operated as an affront to the court's proceedings. On the second issue, he also noted that there was nothing to indicate that this particular rule had been enacted due to any hostility to a legitimate constitutional claim. In regards to discretion, Justice Kennedy felt that even a newly created rule based on factual differences in the case should be able to stand. As he put it, "This should be true even if the principles barring the post-verdict motions are first elaborated in the instant case." He noted that novel facts and circumstances may disclose principles that, while consistent with the logic and rationality the law seeks, and in that sense predictable, still have not yet been defined with precision in earlier cases. This is the dynamic of the case system we rely upon to explain the law. He also noted, as did Justice Roberts in his opinion, that basically what's good for the goose is good for the gander. In Justice Roberts' opinion, he had focused on the policy behind this rule. He said, "A contrary holding would pose an unnecessary dilemma for the states. States could preserve flexibility by granting courts discretion to excuse procedural errors, but only at the cost of undermining the finality of state court judgments. Or states could preserve the finality of their judgments by withholding such discretion, but only at the cost of precluding any flexibility in applying the rules." And by the way, 26 states had filed amicus briefs, and apparently the briefs were influential on the court. Justice Roberts went on to say, "We are told that if forced to choose, many states would opt for mandatory rules to avoid the high costs that come with plenary federal review." He also said the fashioning of rigid rules would be more likely to impair the trial judge's ability to deal fairly with a particular problem than to lead to a just result. The result would be particularly unfortunate for criminal defendants who would lose the opportunity to argue that a procedural default should be excused through the exercise of judicial discretion. He then went on to say, which is particularly important in the comedy area, "In light of the federalism and comedy concerns that motivate the adequate state ground doctrine in the habeas context, it would seem particularly strange to disregard state procedural rules that are substantially similar to those to which we give full force in our own courts." He had earlier noted that there is a federal fugitive forfeiture rule that allows the federal court's discretion, and noted that it would, again, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If they have it in federal court, why should the state courts be limited in not having it? And basically, Justice Kennedy wanted to specifically state that again. He said, "The adequate state ground doctrine ought not to foreclose the case process in the separate states. A too rigorous or demanding insistence that procedural requirements be established in all of their detail before they can be given effect in federal court would deprive the states of the case law decisional dynamic that the judiciary of the United States finds necessary and appropriate for the elaboration of its own procedural rules." And I think importantly he stated, "Save where there is exclusive jurisdiction or federal supremacy, a proper constitutional balance ought not give federal courts latitude in their interpretation and elaboration of its law that it then withholds from the states." He also stated, "It seems most doubtful that this court can or should require federal courts to disregard a state procedural ground that was not in all respects explicit before the case when it was first announced, absent a showing of a purpose or pattern to evade constitutional guarantees." So this case may be limited strictly to its specific holding in the case. On the other hand, if you can see, especially with Justice Kennedy's concurrence and the fact that Stevens and Ginsburg did not dissent or concur in this case, it would, to me, indicate a strong, hopefully, majority on the court that is continuing to show, in my opinion, a more hands-off attitude, particularly in the habeas corpus area of criminal proceedings, in acknowledging that the state courts need flexibility and acknowledging that the federal courts should not engage in overturning the state court decisions that are decided on adequate grounds.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.